He said, I had no idea children could hang on that long. I said, well, we've got 200 of them. We all breathe different times. Those kids were 11, 12 years old, and they just knocked him out when he did that. I think early 60s. No, it came out then. Yeah. It's a collector's item now, see. I think I got 27 cents from the Performers Fund or something on the last check as conductor of this thing. So, since that was successful, when Arnold Sundgaard had a heart attack, Arnold was a longtime friend and librettist with Alec, and Arnold got very depressed, and he was teaching at Williams College in Massachusetts, Williamstown. And Alec came to me and says, what are we going to do about poor Arnold? And I said, what? I didn't know. And he said, well, he's so depressed, and Marge is so worried about him. And I thought, oh, here goes Alec writing something for a friend again. And Arnold had given him a libretto several years before about three old people living in an old folks' home, which was not a thrilling idea to Alec at the time. To do as a little chamber opera, and as the man at Shermer said, who cares about old people, you know? But they did have the redeeming grace of having a little girl who was 12 years old as the soprano lead, and one of the men was a tenor, and one was a bass, and the old lady was a mezzo, so Alec thought that'd make a nice quartet. And he said, to cheer Arnold up, I will set this little chamber opera. And he said, you're the only one who could, you know. And so he wrote it. And one day I came in my office. And again, having no home, he had no place to work. And so he would always work down at Father Henry Atwell's rectory. Or he'd work at Louis Ozer's house. Got kind of mad at Louis when he had children that cried when he wanted to work. And he came to my office often, and I would, you know, meet students elsewhere. And one day I came in, and Alec's down on his hands and knees with a little pair of scissors cutting a hole in my rug. And I said, what's happening? And he said, oh, I was hoping I'd get this done before you came in. He said, he smoked constantly. And he had put a cigarette on the ashtray, which had fallen onto the floor while he was busy writing music, and it had burned a little hole in my new wall-to-wall carpet in the office, which I'd tried 18 years to get them to give me, you know. And he says, I thought if I cut it all out, it wouldn't show, you know. I said, well, I have a choice of a brown spot or a bald spot. I said, leave the brown spot. I said, it will only remind you that you were here, you know. And he began to cry, and he said, oh. I said, that's... And so every now I walk into my studio, and on the left of the piano is this brown spot, and I wished he'd burned more because it would give me more to remember him by. That often he would leave me a note that somebody would stop by, and on one of a yellow pad, you'd find this note. He'd say, some dreadful girl dropped by wearing early rummage sail. And he would go on and describe this. And most descriptive writer you could imagine. And the poor girl, you know, she didn't know. I didn't tell her. So he put this together, and he brought it to me. And Alec Wilder's music changes key about every two measures, as you know. He wrote a harp piece for Eileen Malone, the professor of harp at Eastman, and she limped for about 3 weeks after practice. And she said, 14 pedal changes and three measures, you know, she said. But she did it. Has swollen ankles, but she has a grateful heart, so. So he brought the score to me in pencil, which I have half of because once he was through with it, And so I sat down, and I, as soon as I practiced the page so I could keep track of what it was, I'd have my wife put it on tape, and then I'd work a few more days on the next one. And finally, I finished the whole piece, which runs about 45, 50 minutes maybe. And then I learned all the four singing parts so that I could sing it for him. He always wanted to know, does it work? That was his criteria of if it were successful or not. And people say, I love it. And he says, well, it works. You know, that was his criteria. So I performed it for him, and he said, you've got to do that for Arnold. It would just save his life. So the next thing I knew, I was flying to Albany from Rochester. That's a wonderful trip. And and Marge, Arnold's wife, met us in Albany and drove us out to Williamstown. And so we played the tape, and I sang all the parts, and everyone sat around and cried and agreed that this was a great tonic, and I thought naively that was the end of that. So the next week, Alec came back in town and said, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get a performance of this and bring Arnold to Avon and have it in Avon among all the trees and the grass and the peace. And he said, we won't invite any critics because he said, I don't care what they think. He says, it's for Arnold. And he said, I said, well, you know, you want to stage it, you want to costume it, you want to build sets, you want lights, I said, you want... He said, yes. And it was a single set thing, but the set cost $8,000 just for that. And he said, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could get Joe Mariano to play the flute and Stan Hasty to play the clarinet? He said, oh, well, we'll settle for whoever we can get. And I said, well, what'd you score it for? Wind quintet, string quintet, and percussion, and the four singers. So I said, well, I don't know. So I went to Joe, and these were the core chair players of the old Rochester Philharmonic. They'd played together for years and had left the orchestra and hadn't played for a while. And I said to Joe, Alec wants to know. And Joe says, well, who's going to play oboe? And I said, well, we're going to ask Bob Sprenkel and Stan Hasty. And he says, well, if they'll play, I'll play. So I went to them, and I said, Joe's going to play flute. If he's going to play, I'll play. So I got the whole Oscar Zimmerman on string bass. Oscar was Toscanini's principal bass in the NBC Symphony. And we got Blue Ribbon Group together. And Alec was just about up here. So he asked, Wasserman gave some money, Mitch Miller gave some money, Frank Sinatra gave some money, all his old friends gave money to put this together for Arnold, and we performed it. We couldn't get a legit recording because the union wasn't being too cooperative that year, but we do have some Mapleton cylinders from way up there during a dress rehearsal. And Alex said, what about that wonderful little girl, Irene, that was in children's chorus last year? Could we get a real little girl to play the part? Now, this is what you get into with Alec. You know, you take the little finger, and pretty soon your whole left arm is gone. And it ends up costing you about $800 to do him a favor after. But would we have had it any other way? So I tried out Irene, and she was fine. And he heard Jenny McConnell sing a low alto aria from a Bach Magnificat, and he said, that's the woman that's got to be Mrs. Fitzgerald. And he said, surely John Molloy would do the tenor, and do you have a bass? And I got Bill Briggs, and we got a cast together. The only problem was, during rehearsal, Alec would sit and hold his head in his hands and sit going, oh, no. Oh, no. And John Molloy walked up. He said, you've simply got to get another tenor. I can't go on. He says, he doesn't like me. Everything I sing, he says, no, oh, no. And he says, he moans and groans. And he said, I can't sing. He says, you've got to get another tenor. And I said, no, you don't understand. I said, this is going so incredibly well. that Alex can't believe it. And he's saying, no, oh, oh no. And John said, don't give me that. He says, I have sung. And so I said, Alec, would you explain to him? And that is true, that Alec was saying, my music isn't that beautiful. You're making it better than it really is. And he was a wonderful composer to work with in that respect. He said, you know, if this doesn't work, we'll change it. We'll make it right. You don't like the B flat, we'll make it a G. Just as long as you didn't get the emphasis on the wrong syllable, he was all right. And so we kept John in the show. And when we got close, oh, I think it was a couple of weeks from the performance, Alex said, you know, that girl can really sing, 12 years old. He said, everybody's got an aria in this but Irene. And I thought, oh no, don't write me an aria 2 weeks before the show, because I'd been training her for like 4 months to sing these difficult entrances. He'd write something and then move down a third and then up a fourth and then down a fifth. And I was training Irene. This is what he does. And he sat in a rehearsal and I was coaching her, and he says, I didn't know I did that. And I said, well, you composers write it, we'll analyze it and teach it. But he did write her an aria. He got Arnold on the horn and said, write me some lyrics. And 2 weeks before the show, he wrote an aria for Irene. And I want to play the Mapleson recording of Irene, 12 years old, doing the aria. With some recitative ahead of it here. There's another side of Alec writing a little opera. The next thing that I was intimately involved with was the last world premiere of his that he ever heard, and it was in October of 1980, and he died Christmas Eve of the same year, 1980. And he had written a very tender folk-like piece to a libretto by Lunis McLowan, the pianist, and he has a trio or quartet, trio, from Charlotte, North Carolina. And Lunas had written this loose parallel of the young Christ child, or the young boy, Jesus, called Mountain Boy. And he lives in the Appalachians, and he has an unusual interest in going to preach in the local church. And the mother and father don't understand him. And he wrote this again for John Molloy, who was the tenor in the Truth About Windmills, and Ginny McConnell, who was the lady. And John Molloy had given up singing in public and got down to casting, and he said, well, you sang all the parts of the other thing. You sing the role of the father in this. So I ended up doing that, too. And the boy was just incredible. But here is Virginia McConnell singing Today, He's Just a Boy, and this is from Mountain Boy in 1980. Yes. He had an incredible instinct for what was just right for the moment. Like, that is so Appalachian in general flavor. Some of the most dear memories I have are those intimate times we spent alone doing crazy things. Sometimes he'd call and say, come over to 111, which is where it was the old Sheraton in Rochester. He said, I can't stand to leave this room, and I don't want anyone else in. And you'd go in, and he'd have the windows all up, and he'd have street sounds coming in. He said, I hate those sounds from the street. But he'd have the windows up anyway, because he didn't want to be all that alone. And I sometimes took along a cassette, just in case. And this day, he got to talking about Otto Harbach, of all strange things. And he said, did you know it used to be Hauerbach? And I said, yes, I think I knew that. And then he began to reminisce a little bit about Otto Harbach. And the couple first sounds you'll hear are street sounds, and then the sound of the bobble birds. It sounds like somebody hitting the glass with a spoon. But if they ever stopped, he'd get up and adjust them.
I have a friend who was asked by the son of Otto Harbach to consider writing a biography of it based in part on 28 hours of tape that the son had persuaded his father to make when he knew he was dying, mm-hmm. just to keep him from thinking about dying, about all his reminiscences. And the man was a very extraordinary man because he was a professor. And he came out of an academic world and wound up writing hundreds of shows and many lyrics, among them the lyric for Yesterday's, the current song. I took issue with that book I did on such rhymes as sequestered days. I don't like this, it's a little too pompous. But anyway, he knew everybody. He did all kinds of rewrites. He was kind of a play doctor as well as a writer of musical plots, musical comedy plots. And he certainly was a part of that early time, of the early Kern time. And my friend, Arnold Sengard, wrote 60 pages as a sample to show this man. He went to interview his old 90-year-old brother and went to Salt Lake City where he'd lived, and Arnold was afraid that the man himself wouldn't be that well known because he was always the primary writer, but he was always with somebody else except in the lyrics. He was enormously respected. He was head of ASCAP at one time, and he lived at the Algonquin. I knew him, not well, but I knew him, a charming man. And I believe there was some problems with the wife who drank, the mother of this boy, I think. But when sent to a publisher, these 60 pages as a sample with the outline of what the rest of it was to be, the answer came back, they didn't know who Otto Harbach was. Now, this, I think, still is valid biography.
Are there any questions or comments or anybody wants to make? I True. He spent a lot of time with Fran Miller, Mitch's ex, on the island, and he discovered Florida, and he died in Florida, usually on Christmas Eve. Did I tell you this? But on Christmas Eve, he was so lonesome, having no family. He had an older brother, but they didn't get along, and his sister had died long since, and there was a nephew, but they didn't keep in touch. On his 74th birthday, I did a little commemorative thing at Eastman, and the nephew came and he said, I learned more about my uncle tonight than I ever knew before, because they just weren't together. But Alec always took a train on Christmas Eve. He didn't care where it went. He just bought a ticket. And he didn't want to bother his friends who had families. And he didn't have any. And as he got older, he got increasingly lonely because this daily on the move. And he always flew first class on airplanes because he didn't want to be in with all those people. You know, he really was a very sad, lonely man in many ways. And then he'd be very high at other times. I'd like, if there any other comments? Yeah.
I'd like to thank you for sharing your friendship with us.
It's a pleasure. As you can tell, I'm very fond of the guy still. I would like to end with another version of I'll Be Around, because anybody that did what Alec did will be around through his music and through his writings. And this one is by Diane Carroll, and it is in great contrast to the opening one because it's a real with it arrangement. Sock it.
No matter how you treat me now, I'll be around from now on.
I want to thank Peter for giving me this chance to do this. It's more fun than being on the EC unit. And when he called and said, you know, since you didn't get to do it in Syracuse, would you like to do it in Nashville? I said, try to stop me. So it's been great to be here. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Milford. That try and stop me is a direct quote from of Milford's. It's impossible to follow that, except to say that it's an extraordinary event to sit here and be let in on such an extraordinary relationship and friendship. I've loved Alec Wilder's music for years, and I've loved Milford Fargo for years, and now I feel I know them both a little better. I can't talk too much about this, because there's nothing I can say. We've all, I think, felt it. So let me just say that the bar is still open, I believe. And not quite last call if you drink fast. And tomorrow morning at 8:30, our room C will be open again with coffee and not at 8:30 in the morning. That's a private party, I think. Only the initiated. And again, tomorrow morning at 9, we'll be back in here with the final day of our sessions here in Nashville. I'm getting very confused where I am. Thank you all. I hope you've had as good a time as I have tonight. And let's all do it again next year. It's Mike Beale's turn to plan it. And I think we certainly can. And I want to know what happened to Evelyn.
Those were really great kids. Every spring I auditioned 800 children. And those were the 200 I picked. And the 800 had been screened by their public school teachers before they were sent to me. So it was like being a mosquito in a nudist camp. You knew what should be done, but you didn't know where to begin. You know? So there's one more thing, and of course that was my cue to say, of course. And he wrote it in Old English, and this very staid Renaissance kind of thing. And he called it Uppeth Thine with Turpentine.
I have nothing more to say except let's have fun.
Which